This is Iowa Public Radio's August edition of the Iowa Arts Showcase, our monthly performing arts program devoted to Iowa's not-for-profit arts and cultural organizations. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jacqueline Hallblum. This month, we'll explore the WCF Symphony's 85th season. We'll hear verse composed by Iowa's farmer poet. We'll take a peek at the Iowa State Center's Performing Arts Series. We'll investigate Orchestra Iowa's upcoming season. And we'll celebrate film writers and stars with Iowa connections. That's all ahead on Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase.
I think the historical themes that we illustrate are still themes that we are thinking about as Iowans today. The difference between small town Iowans and urban Iowans and rural Iowans, and those are some of the themes you see in State Fair and even in Field of Dreams. The difference between outsiders that you come across with people like in The Music Man when Harold Hill comes to River City, or Francesca Johnson in the Bridges of Madison County is someone who's not a native-born Iowan, and some of the frustrations she feels as a farm wife, and also then just the beauty of the Iowa landscape that's depicted in a lot of the films, too, and the transformational nature of the Iowa landscape, or what we like to think of as an underappreciated beauty, or some of those themes that come out. So it's an exhibit for people of all ages. We've got some great loans. I think one of the highlight artifacts is on loan to us from the Charles McNider Art Museum, and we've got two of the marionettes on loan to us from The Sound of Music. We've got the boy goat herd and the girl goat from the scene of the Lonely Goat Herd's song that Julie Andrews and the children do. So something for people of all ages. It really is a blockbuster exhibit, and we're excited to invite any Iowans and not Iowans down to see it.
Leo Landis, curator from the State Historical Museum of Iowa, describing their recently opened exhibit called Hollywood in the Heartland. Leo thinks about three-fourths of their exhibit is on loan from private collectors like Mason City's Craig Benebus. He also says the State Historical Museum has something for all ages.
Even if you don't think you like history, you'll be surprised at the things you'll discover. Our two most recent exhibits are Hollywood in the Heartland, which opened this summer, and then Riding Through History, which discusses bicycling.
Tell us about this marvelous Hollywood exhibit. What is it all about?
It has three main features. One is the theaters across the state. And the project started with our Historic Preservation Office, which is part of the Department of Cultural Affairs. We did a survey of over 200 theaters across the state. And then we said, we really ought to look at not just the built environment that shapes the small and large towns of Iowa, but also the people who have accomplished solid careers in the state, and also how our state is depicted in popular culture, especially in film. And Iowa, being what we think of as the heart of the heartland, often gets selected to be the quintessential Midwestern or Americana environment. So going back to a film released in the early 1920s, The Wonderful Thing, that was filmed in Centerville, up to The Bridges of Madison County, even films today. But we wanted to address then how the films have depicted Iowa and Iowans, and thought that that was a good, solid historical hook.
Now tell us, you have a whole list of actors who are from Iowa, and you have a huge collection of artifacts as well.
There have been some great actors from Iowa. People think of John Wayne and Cloris Leachman and Donna Reed, the three Academy Award winners, but you have people like Gene Seberg from Marshalltown, or Raymond Hatton from Red Oak, Michelle Monaghan today from Winthrop in northeast Iowa, but then a great actor from Haywarden who was nominated for an Academy Award in 1950, Hope Emerson, who gets typecast because she's 6'2 and weighs over 200 pounds, but she really was a great talent and was nominated for a role in a film called Cage. So we celebrate the known and the unknown actors who've had great careers, and people have been great at collaborating with us, people like Tom Arnold, Ron Livingston from Marion and Cedar Rapids area. He loaned us some artifacts, including his clapper that was used in Office Space and a script from Office Space. Ashton Kutcher has loaned us an artifact, and of course the Academy Award from Cloris Leachman will be on exhibit the entire run of our show.
And I was surprised to see a list of Iowa Writer Workshop grads as well.
And that's one of the reasons why we think Iowa has been depicted so often in film, is because it takes a great script to make a great movie, and we've got a great creative writing program at the University of Iowa. And with people like Jane Smiley or people like W.P. Kinsella, who did Shoeless Joe, which becomes Field of Dreams, you get these great writers coming out of our program, and they write about what they know, and sometimes that's our state. So even if they're not native Iowans, like Jane is from California, W.P. Kinsella is from Canada, they write about our state, and it gets made into a Hollywood movie.
And you just mentioned briefly about the historic theaters in Iowa as well. Just tell us a bit about that architecture and the list of theaters.
Right. You can learn about theaters, how they started out as opera houses often in small towns and large towns. Dubuque, Cedar Rapids, Davenport, a lot of the river towns that were the larger towns in the state, then moving into smaller towns like Akron and the Charles Theater in Charles City, which is a great representation of Art Nouveau architecture that people don't think of being in our smaller towns across the state. So you can learn about how architects shaped our town's environments that way, the built environment.
And you're also including this matinees at the museum, a great idea.
We're really excited to be able to feature some of those films. So we're beginning with, in October, we'll have Cold Turkey, which is a film that is sometimes underappreciated, and it's both, I think, timeless and a little dated. It was filmed in 1969 in Iowa. Norman Lear comes to Winterset and Greenfield and Des Moines to do the filming. And my favorite scene is the opening scene, because you see the Confederate battle flag flying over our governor's mansion. So it was depicting what was supposed to be a tobacco magnate's home. So we've had the Confederate battle flag flying on our governor's mansion. It was a private home at the time, but it really is a great film.
And then you have a couple of more films coming up through the end of this year as well.
We do. In November, we'll be showing a film that starred both John Wayne and Donna Reed called They Were Expendable. It was a World War II era film, and since November has Veterans Day in it, we're highlighting that film with Donna Reed and John Wayne. And then in December, we're doing what we call a Donna double. We'll have Mary Owen, who's Donna Reed's daughter. She'll be in town to talk about her mom and her mom's career, but we'll be showing It's a Wonderful Life, which is what people often think of when they think of Donna Reed as an actor, and then we'll also have her Academy Award performance in From Here to Eternity. So depending on what film you want to see, or if you want to see both, they're free and open to the public during our regular operating hours, the first Saturday of the month. So if you just mark that on your calendar, you'll be able to see those films. And one of the things that we also have tried to promote are the film festivals across the state that are highlighting independent work by Iowa filmmakers. Two of the film festivals in Des Moines are the Interrobang and also the Wild Rose Film Festival, and you've got the Heart Acre in Tipton and the Iowa Independent Film Festival in Mason City, so lots of great programs across the state.
How can folks get more information and find out more details about this exhibit and about the museum?
The best way to find out about us is going to iowahistory.org. The website will list our hours, what our other exhibits are, and can be a way to, if you have questions, learn about the museum and other programs at the State Historical Building.
Leo Landis, curator of the State Historical Museum of Iowa. Leo invites everyone to come to the museum this afternoon at 1:15 for the Film State Fair, and on September 6th, The Music Man, as part of their Matinees in the Museum series. Just ahead, events that altered James Hurst's life forever. Details about Iowa State's new performing arts series, Orchestra Iowa's next season, and information about the WCF Symphony's 2014-15 concert lineup. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase.
I think traditionally symphonic music has been sort of narrowly defined as being only for a certain group of people. And what we're trying to do is make sure the community realizes that what we do is really for everybody. And so hence the variety of our concerts, and also then the single words that we've chosen for each concert to help really define what the central aspect of that concert is.
Jason Weinberger, Artistic Director and CEO of the WCF Symphony. The orchestra's mantra this year is something for everybody. Their October 11th concert is called Celebrate.
This is the celebration of the opening formally of our 85th season at the Gallagher Bluedorn Performing Arts Center. Project Trio is our guest artist. These guys are amazing. It's a flute, cello, and bass trio. The flutist is kind of world famous because of his YouTube videos. He's well known as the beatboxing flutist, Greg Patillo. But this group does great stuff. Their approach to concert music is just amazing. And that's the musical theme of this concert. It's a real variety of wonderful American styles.
And you're going to have a bit of Bernstein and Adam Schoenberg on this concert as well.
Yeah, Adam Schoenberg's a wonderful young composer. We're going to do his piece called American Symphony. And then we're also going to play music of Leonard Bernstein, this time the suite from On the Waterfront.
What surprises do you have in store for us in November?
Everything is a surprise in November. We're featuring the winner of the UNI Midwest International Piano Competition, which took place in June. And we also are featuring the audience choice winner piece from our April concert, when we offered the audience a chance to choose between Firebird, Scheherazade, Tchaikovsky's Sixth Symphony, and Shostakovich's Tenth Symphony. And we're not going to announce the music or even print it in the program. The audience will simply show up knowing they're going to hear one of those four symphonic masterworks, and they're going to hear a great piano concerto with the winner of the competition. And we chose a piece by Ted Hearn, a young up-and-coming composer. It's a very surprising, funny piece that opens the program. So this will be different. The audience is going to come sort of knowing they're going to hear a great piano concerto and a great symphony, but not knowing actually what the pieces are. So this is exciting for us, something we've never tried.
Well, hopefully the orchestra and you know what the pieces are, Jason.
Right. Well, we've sworn all those folks to secrecy.
Well, tell us about December, and this sounds like fun.
What this is a sing-along to Handel's Messiah. And what's unique about this is to really entice folks to participate with us. We've done something very different in terms of the tickets on this concert. All tickets are $5. And we're also going to feature not only Met Chorale, which is kind of leading the choral part of this, but we're going to feature some students from local universities who will be auditioning to sing some arias, and we'll feature the orchestra in a few instrumental tunes. So it'll be a hybrid concert and sing-along, and we think it's going to be a lot of fun and, of course, very accessible, and that was our goal with this concert in December.
And then you're going to head back to the Brown Derby.
In fact, as was the case last year with our Mozart concert, where we tried to recreate the setting and the feeling of a concert in the 1780s in Vienna, this is going back to the 19-teens, when Schoenberg led a group of musicians in arranging large works for a small ensemble of about 10, 11, 12 musicians, and then presented these concerts in a room for about 200 people as a private musical society. Well, the Brown Derby, again, is just about the same size as this room. So once again, we're transporting the audience to Vienna of a different era, and we'll be presenting Mahler's Fourth Symphony in the arrangement that Erwin Stein created for Schoenberg's concerts in the 19-teens. So I think this is going to be a really neat opportunity to get a different view on Mahler, and also to transport ourselves again to a different period in musical history.
And then this marvelous work of Schubert.
Yes, in March we return to the Gallagher Bluedorn to present Schubert's Unfinished Symphony. And not just the movements that folks are familiar with, which constitute the first and second movements of what was going to be a complete symphony, but we're also going to perform a completion of Schubert's sketches for the third movement, and we will perform a movement from the Rosamund incidental music that Schubert wrote, which some scholars believe might have started its life as the finale of an unfinished symphony. Even if it didn't, it's in the proper key and it's sort of the right type of movement. And so we call this concert Imagine, where we will create a kind of an imaginary version of Schubert's Unfinished Symphony and exploring some of the issues that surround the piece during that presentation.
And you're going to have a world premiere, and that's just fabulous.
Yeah, we have a big world premiere in April. That's our penultimate concert. We're going to feature the composer and violinist Daniel Bernard Romain, who's a very interesting musician and performer, Haitian descent, brings a lot of different cultural reference points into his music, is a great, very exciting performer, does some highly unusual things with his own instrument and also what he asked the orchestra to do. And he is not only going to present his own violin concerto, which has been around now for a couple of years, he is also going to be writing a new work for us, which is an update or a rethinking of Benjamin Britten's Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra. And this piece will also be performed on our youth concerts the same week. So not only will our audience have a chance to enjoy this world premiere, but we're going to really be engaging some young people here in the Cedar Valley in the creation of a new work, which it also happens to be really a wonderful educational topic, of course, the Guide to the Orchestra. So very excited about hosting Daniel and presenting this concert, which is, again, kind of a return to some of our focus on American music, and the entire concert is comprised of American music, Daniel's music, plus pieces by Copland, Barber, Joan Tower, and Charles Ives.
Tell us then about your last concert of the season.
Well, we close our 85th season with a really special event. We'll be performing Fantasia live with the film. And of course, we've performed The Wizard of Oz and several other works with film. So this is one of the most famous musical films we'll be performing.
And tell us about how you're kicking off the season. This is going to be great fun.
Yes, we are opening our season at the Riverloop Amphitheater in Waterloo in downtown. And Riverloop is a wonderful venue for a concert. That early September time is a great period of time to enjoy music outdoors. And this year we're going to celebrate the river, which flows literally about 30 feet behind the percussion section, with music by Duke Ellington, a suite that he wrote called The River, which is really wonderful, very enjoyable, accessible piece. And we're also going to open the season with another world premiere by Daniel Gilliam called Sweet Rivers. And this work is based on an early American hymn tune. And Daniel himself was really intrigued by this idea. So this whole concert is a wonderful celebration of the setting there and the Cedar River, which runs through, of course, our lives here in the Cedar Valley.
So how can folks get more information and tickets and the whole nine yards?
One of the nice things nowadays, if you can kind of remember that we've changed our name officially to WCF Symphony, well, when you Google that, you find our website, you find our Facebook page and our Twitter account. So I encourage folks to pick a convenient way that they'd like to be connected with us, and we'll make sure everyone has the information they need about all of our events.
The WCF Symphony's Artistic Director and CEO, Jason Weinberger, talking about their 2014-15 season. Just ahead, we'll investigate Iowa State Center's upcoming artist series. We'll catch a few details about Orchestra Iowa's next season, and we'll learn about Iowa's farmer poet, James Hurst. This is the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio.
The Strongest Magic. Anger pens me in a sty, shapes me bestial, with snout and tail, bathes me in filth when I wallow in stale pride, fills my nose, I sleep in sour straw, eat from a trough, squeal when the prod strikes, light glazes my red eyes, a cold wind brings me bad dreams. I grunt hairy thoughts, crazed by blood surges, until you laugh the beast into its shadow, when your kiss turns me to a man again. It's a pretty strange love poem, isn't it? He's a pig, but gets turned into a man from his beloved's kiss.
Dr. George Day, University of Northern Iowa Professor Emeritus, reading the poetry of Iowa's farmer poet, James Hurst.
Had it not been for the accident, he probably would have been a farmer all his life. He might have written some because he was a little bit precocious in that way. In junior high, for example, he reduced or transformed some of the short stories they read into rhymed couplets. Isn't that unusual? So I think he had a literary bent, and the family, particularly the mother and her side, was inclined toward literature, reading good things. They were educated. Several of his uncles were doctors, and an aunt was a medical doctor. And so there was a literary background there. But, you know, I think that terrible as it was, what's the old saying? It's an ill wind that blows nobody any good. that the accident caused him to become a serious poet, and we are the beneficiaries of that.
Tell us kind of about his life. He had attended at least 1 year at the Iowa State Teachers College.
Yes, it was after that first year that he had his accident, and he was, by his own admission, not an outstanding student. He didn't try very hard. He loved sports, and he played baseball and I think a little basketball, and he was quite good at baseball. He was a pitcher, and he even was good enough that he hired out, this is funny, under an assumed name and pitched for some teams in the northern part of the state. And, of course, that came to an end, and that was one of the many sorrows that he had to face. But he was involved in the usual college activities. He belonged to a popular fraternity. I think his brother had belonged to it also. And as a matter of fact, it was a fraternity get-together up on the Cedar River where he was swimming and where he made the fatal dive. And he has poems and reminiscences in his autobiography about dating girls and carrying on a correspondence with them. And actually, to tell the truth, or at least to according to his autobiography, that did not cease with the accident. He had some girlfriends in the hospital, close relationships with nurses, and we know that he had two wives that with whom he had a good marriage, or a good relationship. And that's one of the things that I would stress always about James Hirst, is that on the one hand, he had this devastating accident that ruined his life. It ruined his inability to walk, even the simplest of things. He had to have help always. And yet, he did so many things. He farmed. He was lifted up on the tractor, and he plowed and he cultivated. He taught, as we know, both here at ISTC and at the Aspen Institute in summers, and even in a summer school in Mexico. Traveled widely, almost entirely in this country, with exception of Mexico. And, you know, he belonged to a poker club and a supper club where they gave papers, and he managed, heroically, I think, to live as normal, quote-unquote, a life as it would be possible to live, given the limitations that he had.
And almost a miracle in the sense that when he had this diving accident and he broke his neck in this swimming accident,
yes,
that he lived, because at that time, a lot of times, if people broke their neck, it was like a death sentence right away.
Yes. Frequently, people did not live beyond a broken neck or lived in an iron lung or something like that, but he was a man of great determination, although he hated exercise. He always said that was the one thing in life that he hated. He loathed exercise, but he did it. He followed the regimen that he was given, underwent therapy and followed that, and forced himself to lift weights, and then fought his way back. And I think he can't help but be inspirational, really. He would not have liked that word, but it's true.
And then after this, he taught himself. He started reading books, and then the more he read, then he started to write.
Yes. He was, I suppose you would say, almost completely self-taught, except for that year at ISTC. But his sister worked in the library at the State College, and she brought him books all the time, the latest books. And he set himself goals, reading goals. For example, in poetry, when he began to become serious about writing verse, he didn't know anything about it. He didn't know about the technical terms of meter and rhyme and so on. So he got every book that he could on those subjects and virtually memorized them. And then later he taught not only writing, but taught literature courses. One that impressed me is he taught 20th century British and American poetry. And those poets are far and away different from him in their styles and tone and many times subject matter. But he mastered them.
Tell us, George, how did your life intersect with James Hirst?
Well, it was very interesting and very fortunate for me. I came at UNI in 1967, my first college teaching job. At some point, I don't remember when it was exactly, I was introduced to Jim Hirst. And he was a great person to probe in a nice way other people's lives and interests. He'd ask you many questions. Someone he was just introduced to, he'd spend 10 or 20 minutes asking about them. Well, he asked me about my life, and it turned out that we had a number of things in common. I was from a small rural community in Nebraska. Most of my high school classmates were farm kids, and we did business with farmers, and we were just surrounded by the agricultural way of life. And then I had the opportunity presented to me to go into my family's business. My father suffered a heart attack, and I, like Jim Hirst, had to drop out of college and went to work there and liked it and did okay, but I was always frustrated that I had not completed my degree. So I made arrangements to go back for a year and get my degree, which I did. But during that year, my whole attitude was transformed. I met professors who urged me to go into teaching and were good to me. And anyway, I then went to graduate school, earned an MA, taught in high school for a while, and then got a PhD and ended up university teaching. Well, that fascinated Jim. And I've known in other instances of faculty members and people who had switched careers and done something markedly different from what they were originally planning to do. And it had happened to him, of course. He had had no idea when he was 19 years old that he'd end up being a college professor. And so that, I think, was a bond between us, maybe the initial one. And after that, we became good friends. I was frequently at their house. He often asked me over. He and Merle were at my house several times for meals. We always kept in touch. He wrote me good letters when I was on leave. And we had what I would call a good, rich, close relationship. I'm not saying I was his closest friend, because Jim had many, many friends. But we were good friends, and I treasure that.
Tell us, now he had, in addition to you at his house, he brought students to his house. That's where they came for classes. They came to the home,
yes,
to study. And then he also had several very prominent writers that came to visit him as well.
Yes, and I had the good fortune to be in on a couple of those. I was the chairman, I think it was, of the college, or maybe this is the English department, speakers committee. And in those days, there seemed to be enough money that we had a lot of good speakers. Many, many very preeminent critics, poets, novelists came to UNI and gave lectures and spent some time conferring with students. And I would kind of get in on it because I would charge of the visiting speakers as they were when they were on campus. Two of them I remember well, and I think they say a lot about the kind of person and the kind of artist that Jim was. One was the Midwest Iowa writer Frederick Manfred. He was a prolific novelist of the early years on the prairie, wrote a number of novels about Native Americans, wrote a classic novel about the story of Hugh Glass, the fur trapper who was left to die and then crawled his way back several hundred miles to civilization. So that author, Fred Manfred, was chosen to be the dedicatory speaker at the new edition of the library. The new edition was really a completion of the fourth floor, which is now the center of the arts, music, and literary books, and even the art and music library is on that fourth floor. It's a great center. So anyway, he came to town and gave a very fine speech, which I do hope is preserved in the university archives. It should be reprinted. But I had told him, and he'd heard of Jim Hirst, of course, and I had hoped to get them together and learn some of the secrets of their profession of writing. And they were both eager to meet one another. So I took Frederick Manfred down Searley, down to the Hirst home, well supplied with a pen and a notebook, stuffed away in my coat pocket, prepared to take down any golden words that should be immortalized. Well, here's the way the conversation went. It started out, Jim said to Fred, "Where did you learn to write?" Fred said, "Well, I didn't really learn to write. I don't believe you can teach writing." And Jim replied, "I don't either." And that was the extent of their talking about literature. So my hopes were foiled. But what was interesting was that they loved to talk and did a great deal talking about farm machinery, old hay balers, old thrashing machines, steam-run thrashing machines, farm dogs, and old automobiles. The automobiles stymied me because I thought I knew something about old cars, but they talked about brands that I'd never heard of before. So I think that shows you a little something about James Hirst. He was an artist, and he had his own theories of art, but they weren't so highfalutin and they weren't so abstract that he wanted to spend a lot of time talking with another writer about them. He liked to talk about the hard, solid facts of farm life, like dogs and tractors.
And a lot of his writing reflects the rural background, and that was really what he wanted to talk about or write about.
Yes, yes, he loved to talk about the farm. It informed his life in many ways, and of course, as you say, it informed his poetry too. You know, James Hirst is often compared to Robert Frost. Robert Frost was, yes, a rural poet, but he was a New England farm poet, and those farms are so different than our Midwestern farms. They're very small, they're rocky, the soil is not as rich as ours, and I think you can say of Jim Hirst's farm poems, they're the real deal. They're not just a literary device.
Now, Robert Frost came to Cedar Falls to visit James Hirst, and he also had another really well-known author.
Yes, both Robert Frost and Carl Sandburg came, and there are pictures of them. One of them is in an old issue of North American Review with Carl Sandburg. But I might just tell you two quotes from those visits. I was not there, of course. That was long before I came to UNI. But Jim told me these stories himself. When Robert Frost came, he wanted to see Jim Hirst's farm. So they took him out to Maplehurst, as it was called, a little southwest of town. And he was very impressed with the spaciousness of it, the long furrows of corn, and the richness of the soil. He just admired that rich soil, which would stand in strong contrast to the rocky New England landscape. He looked down at the soil, Jim said, and said these words, "Oh, that's so black and rich and good, that soil. I could just get down on my hands and knees and eat it and bypass the vegetables." And then, if I may tell the Sandburg story, this is just a little bit of humor, and Jim liked to do this. He could imitate people's voices quite well, and he does that in his poems often, creates a persona and then uses the kind of voice that they would use, the tone of voice. At any rate, he was having a good time with Carl Sandburg, and Sandburg went into a disputation about being famous as a result of being a published poet. And he says, newspapers all write you up, and you're on the radio, and the magazines put articles on you. And then, and here Jim launched into what I gather was a very close imitation of Sandburg's rather nasal drawl. He said, "Then, and after all this fame, you can still get the measles." Jim used to laugh over that, drawing out measles.
And he had a really good sense of humor as well.
Yes, he did. He wrote a lot of comical poems, and he could see the humor in many things. And this is one of the things that strikes me about James Hirst, that terrible accident that left him so helpless. In spite of that, he had this successful career, or two careers, but his personality, he wasn't embittered. He wasn't sour. He wasn't cynical, at least not that you could see. And he rarely referred to his accident and his limitation. One time I overheard him refer to it. There are no poems that go into his accident, his situation. I think there's one poem about a wheelchair and one about a grab bar because he needed that to get him up. But no poor me kind of poems asking for our sympathy. He was amiable. He liked people. He liked his students. I've talked to students who appreciated his humor. In fact, I talked to several who went to this classroom that you referred to in the basement. In fact, I brought part of a letter from one of them. Would you allow me to read that?
Yes, please.
A student of mine had been a student of James Hurst's, and so I wrote her. She's now a successful photographer and poet in her own right, and asked her if she had any reminiscences about Jim that she would like to tell. And what she sent me, well, a couple of reminiscences, but the neat thing was that she sent me part of a letter that he had written her several years ago when she had had a child after being out of college a few years, and the child was, I think, 2 and a half. Here's what he wrote in his letter. Your letter was such a pleasant surprise that the rain stopped and the sun came out. You didn't know that you had that power, did you? Well, be careful. Be careful how you use it. You might let it rain when the Methodists want a Sunday school picnic, or have the sunshine when the farmers wanted rain. But we are delighted to hear from you. The only sad thing is to think how time has gone by. Your child, 2 and a half years old? I can't believe it. You know, I have never been a housewife nor a mother, but from where I sit, it looks like the most creative job in the whole world, maybe next to farming. But I used to cook, and I had a recipe for beef stroganoff in a book of recipes by American poets. And in the fine print of our marriage contract, it says that I am to have homemade bread. So Merle, who couldn't boil water without burning it when we were first married, is now one of the best bread makers in Iowa. That's the quintessential James Hurst, that expression of affection and gratitude, but mixing in with it humorous commentary.
I see you have a book here, The Complete Poetry of James Hurst, and has many markers in it, and I'd ask you to possibly read a couple of short poems for us.
I'd be glad to do that. There's such a variety of poems that in some ways it's easy to pick out different kinds of poems. I thought first I'd read a short one. It has to do with a rock, a boulder in his field that he can't get rid of. And it's not the one about how to find truth, plow it and find out. Names for an obstacle, and this obstacle is a big, heavy rock that he can't get rid of. This iceberg of granite, with its heft underground, hedges in my field and dooms my way. It won't budge for chains, stone hammers, or dynamite. So I go around it with my plow, and my crops grow where it lies. This glacial snag, dotted with bird stains, circled by weeds, seamed with scars, this exile from time, ancient as grief, a tusk thrust from the depths of Earth's ocean. I think we can see that rock there that has stymied him. Then I'd like to read one more, which is about a person. And I think we all maybe know this kind of a person. I think of the person as perhaps Henry David Thoreau, or maybe even Jesus Christ. It's called What Shall We Do? It's really a small matter, hardly worth official notice. But a citizen of our village walks his own path. He has been known to uphold a friend behind his back. He has been known to mention the death of an old tree. He has been known to handle facts without gloves. He has been known to cancel the debt of a mortgaged boy. He has been known to enjoy walking against the wind. He has been known to feed crows in a hungry winter. He has been known to sit in the sun on a working day. What shall we do with this man? Would he be safe on a committee? Even our children beg to follow him.
Dr. George Day, University of Northern Iowa Professor Emeritus, reading the poetry of James Hurst. In 1983, Jim Hurst and his wife gave their home to the city of Cedar Falls. They stipulated that it was to be revamped as a community center. This year, the center celebrates its 25th anniversary with programs commemorating the life and work of James Hurst. For more information, please go to hurstartscenter.com. For more details about James Hurst, please read his autobiography called My Shadow Below Me. Just ahead, details about Orchestra Iowa's new season and Iowa State Center's upcoming artist series. This is the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio.
It's a variety of different types of shows that we feel are important for all ages and people who know music, or it might be their first time coming to Stevens. It's a very welcoming atmosphere, and we encourage people to try something new.
And there's no substitute for a live performance. And that, of course, goes for classical music and theater, everything. I mean, you can watch a movie, but there's nothing that can replace that live experience. And it's just so exciting. So wherever you go or whatever you do, just add the live performance arts in your life.
Patty Cotter, ISU's development and sponsorship manager at Iowa State Center, along with the center's outreach coordinator, Sarah Compton, filling us in on next year's Performing Arts Series. Welcome back. This is the Iowa Art Showcase. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom.
Well, we love for people to start the year off with laughter. So we do have Spank, which is a parody on the best-selling book series. So that's going to be adult humor, we would say, but just a very well-written parody of the novel's 50 Shades of Grey. And everything we see about that show makes it look like just a lot of fun to kind of have a naughty look at a naughty book, might be the way to put it. And then Colin Mockrey and Brad Sherwood are from the Whose Line Is It Anyway franchise, kind of a comedy franchise. And they will do some improv, including pulling people up on stage and just making fun of almost anything that hits their fancy that night.
Patty and Sarah, tell us about the center's other performing arts series offerings.
We're bringing Stomp back, which is just a phenomenal show. And I really like the creativity of Stomp to just see what people have come up with as ways to make noise. It's almost like your little kids banging on pots, but it's taken to a new visual theatrical level. So we are doing two shows of Stomp in the spring. And then we'll also have Anything Goes, which is kind of a classic musical, Love Found on the Ship. You know, it's going to be kind of a nautical theme. And then we're excited to also bring Million Dollar Quartet, the rockabilly story, kind of going back to Sun Records in Memphis and the start of that whole sound. So that's going to be a wonderful show as well. Also within the musical genre, we are going to bring in Elf, which is a very well-loved holiday musical. We're looking forward to family audiences for that one.
And Sister Act, is that coming as well?
That is. And, you know, that's another wonderful movie that has a huge fan base. And I just love the idea of the criminal who has to be guarded behind the convent walls. You know, she has to go into the witness protection program. And where would you least likely find somebody? In a convent.
So, Sarah, tell us about the classical offerings this year.
Oh, we're really excited. Both of our orchestras this year, our international orchestras, are returning engagements. The Moscow State Symphony Orchestra is coming with Pavel Kogan again conducting, and Nadja Salernin-Sonneberg is guest soloist violin, and they will be presenting an all Tchaikovsky program. And, you know, Nadja's been in Central Iowa several times over the last few years, and we have a wonderful relationship, and she is a phenomenal player. And then also coming back is the State Symphony of Mexico. They were last here a few years ago and just blew everybody away with the passion and fire that they played. It was just an amazing program. So we're very excited about those performances, and we're proud to bring international orchestras to Central Iowa.
And then you said you were also doing a collaboration with a string quartet. Tell us about that.
We are collaborating with Ames, Town & Gown in presenting some chamber music, and that's the Hermes Quartet, is a young French quartet that will soon be on everyone's lips. They're really the hot ticket right now. They won the Young Concert Auditions in 2012, and we are proud to present them with the Ames, Town & Gown at the end of October.
So some terrific things, and just briefly mention some of the theater and the variety performances as well as dance that you have coming.
Yeah, we are very excited to bring the National Acrobats from China. That's a really crowd-pleasing show with towers of chairs and balancing. And another family-oriented show is Mummenschanz, which is a renowned Swiss mime troupe. A lot of really fun mime activity. And The Great Gatsby, and that will be presented by Montana Rep, which is a company we've really enjoyed bringing back to Stevens with some of the great titles in American literature.
And you have a couple of major Irish groups coming as well.
Yeah, a strong Celtic presence with Danu. They were here a couple years ago, and we loved them, so we're bringing them back, and they have a special guest. And then also the Chieftains, which is another standard, wonderful, well-renowned Irish group, Celtic
music.
And
you're having some Australian BG people?
The tribute group is going to be doing standard BG's repertoire, and it's a very fun way to kind of relive the years of the BG's. So that one gets people up and dancing, I would have to admit.
And speaking about getting up and dancing, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the Nutcracker.
Our local Nutcracker is so beloved, and we bring professional dancers in the two roles of the Sugar Plum Fairy and her Cavalier, and lots, over probably 200 local dancers get to be part of the Nutcracker, get to dance on stage at Stevens. It's really a tradition for many people, and just the tinkling of Tchaikovsky and getting you in the holiday mood is really fun for us to present.
And Sarah, tell us about the Amazing Youth Matinee series, because you have some terrific shows coming.
Oh, we're proud of our Youth Matinee series and the educational links that it provides to educators and all ages, really. I mean, we have homeschool families, and we have stay-at-home moms that come, and of course, you know, hundreds of schools throughout Central Iowa, and actually pretty much throughout the state. We've hit both the Missouri River and the Mississippi and everything in between coming to the performances. But we have a lot of literature tie-ins. Harry the Dirty Dog is going to come see us again. Curious George. We have a story medley from TheaterWorks. And then for a little bit older kids, we also have Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief, which is a popular take on the Greek classics and tying that into current literature, and To Kill a Mockingbird, which is a timeless classic for the older students. In the fall, right before election time, we have a wonderful work called We the People, which takes kids through the democratic process. And we have a science show this year, Let's Go Science, where they get to do a lot of experiments and learn some of those fundamentals on stage. And I think last but not least, we'd talk about the ISU Symphony Concert. We also do a youth symphony concert each year where we're proud to present the ISU Symphony to school kids. And Jacob Harrison, the Iowa State conductor, does a wonderful job of explaining and relating the music to the students. And it's a powerful, powerful way to spend a morning.
So how do folks get more information and get tickets and get to these concerts?
Well, we have a wonderful website with a lot of video and audio samples, and Sarah and I both encourage people to check something out to see what it's like. If you don't know about Mumenschanz, you might see the video and then realize, oh, that's just right for my six-year-old. So a lot of samples on the website, which is center.iastate.edu. If you'd rather have some hard copy materials, we'd be happy for you to call us at 515-294-3347.
Patty Cotter, Development and Sponsorship Manager, along with Outreach Coordinator Sarah Compton from ISU's Iowa State Center, filling us in on next year's Performing Arts Series. Just ahead, Orchestra Iowa's new season. This is the Iowa Arts Showcase on Iowa Public Radio. Orchestra Iowa's music director and conductor Tim Hankowich is thrilled and excited about conducting new works for their upcoming season. The weekend of October 18th showcases their Symphonie Fantastique program.
Our first Masterworks concert of the season is very much in tune with a Halloween type of theme. Not only do we have Symphonie Fantastique, which is literally a musical depiction of an opium dream, including movements where he thinks he's killed somebody, but it also includes other works like the Manfred Overture, which also includes a protagonist who actually summons spirits from the dead. And then, of course, our soloist, Winston Choi, is playing the Prokofiev Second Piano Concerto, which is one of the most spine-chilling pieces ever written. So take all those three pieces in context, and you've got a great Halloween program.
And tell us about, then, your November concert.
I'm really excited about our cello soloist, Nara Kaknazarian, who's going to be joining us for this particular program. And in 2011, he was the Tchaikovsky competition winner. And so here's somebody that I think is going to just take the world by storm. So with Nara Kaknazarian, as our centerpiece, I was able to put two pieces around him. We're doing Ravel's Tombeau de Couperin, which is essentially an oboe concerto. It's incredibly difficult, and luckily for us, we have the brilliant talents of David Hempel, our principal oboist. And of course, because we're in Czech country, one of the Dvorak symphonies that I have not yet had a chance to tackle is his Sixth Symphony, and it's just this wonderful, jubilant, joyous work. So it really is old world masters, but with a little bit of a new world flair with some new talent.
Tell us about your March concert.
In our March program, Beethoven and the Bard, we're of course featuring music of Beethoven and other music inspired by the plays of Shakespeare. And so we're beginning with Mendelssohn's Overture to Midsummer Night's Dream. And then Uriel Tahor, who's on faculty at the University of Iowa, who I've been wanting to work with for years now, is going to be joining us with my favorite of the five Beethoven piano concertos, his fourth piano concerto. And we're going to round that program off with the third of Sibelius' symphonies.
And what about your Russian Masters concert?
Brian Lewis, a wonderful violinist, has been on my radar for a very long time. I worked with him many years back in Kansas City, and I know he's guested here prior to my arrival. And then finally, it's been great to be able to get him here. And I know there's a lot of fans of Russian music in this area, and so he'll be joining us with the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto. And that's such a tour de force, you have to end the concert with that. And so what else are we going to program with that? And so I thought, because we've performed most of the Tchaikovsky symphonies and the like, there's one piece out there which hasn't been played here in a very long time, and that is the Borodin Second Symphony. You couple that with an overture, a light overture by Glazunov, and there you have three Russian masters.
And tell us about water music. Any barges included in this?
I wish, yeah. You know, that's funny. The piece that really started the impetus for this program was our brass section really wanted to do a piece by Respighi called The Fountains of Rome. And that's a short but very powerful work. And so what else were we going to put around that? And it just so happened that another wish list piece was La Mer by Debussy. And then I realized, my goodness, we're talking a lot of water here, if we're an ocean and some fountains. And so we're rounding the program with the Overture to the Flying Dutchman, which is probably the storm to end all storms. And another Debussy piece called Nocturne, which ends with this female siren chorus as though they are seducing sailors to their watery grave. So with those four works, we have a lot of water. And thank goodness we're playing indoors.
And tell us then about your Showcase Chamber Series. You have some more marvelous concerts for this coming season.
We have three programs of our Chamber Series, and this has been one of our most successful series as we play two concerts in Cedar Rapids and one in Iowa City. And this year, again, we are on a Concertmaster search, and so each of these Chamber Series will be featuring a Concertmaster candidate. So it'll be very exciting. And as always, our musicians have come up with an incredible broad range of repertoire that really engages our audiences.
So tell us about some of the other shows. You have some fantastic ballets and holiday offerings and a cirque event.
Yes, you are right. We're doing a cirque show the end of our season, I think.
It's in May.
Yeah, basically the symphony gets to play a lot of light classics, and we have these incredible gymnasts and acrobats from the Cirque du Soleil troupe coming in doing a lot of incredible physical art, and so should be extremely popular. There are a lot of other things that the orchestra is doing that you wouldn't necessarily think of, you know, masterwork symphonic music. And of course, we're talking about opera, ballet, and we're even collaborating with TCR. And one series that has grown immeasurably is our ballet series. Of course, we're doing our annual Nutcracker around Christmas, but we're also now doing a Dracula in October, and most of that's going to be pre-recorded music, but there will be a live string quartet there. We're doing Romeo and Juliet in February, which is going to be spectacular. It's one of the greatest scores ever written, and I think most of our musicians are just salivating over that one. And of course, and then another more traditional ballet of Sleeping Beauty of Tchaikovsky. And in addition to that, we're partnering with the opera with a performance of Mozart's Don Giovanni in January, and that should be very exciting. And our partnerships don't stop there, as we'll also be partnering with Theater Cedar Rapids in a Rodgers and Hammerstein program. And so it's going to be a great experience for the entire family.
And the whole season this year kicks off with Bruce Orchestra. Tell us about this terrific concert.
Well, I am happy to say that after a year and a half of editing and album design and all sorts of things, that at Brucemore we will be officially releasing our recording of Michael Dougherty's American Gothic. And so that's going to be the first time we splash that off to the world. It's been a lengthy process, mostly because we've all been in different parts of the country. But now that we're just putting the final touches on this recording, I am extremely excited to be releasing it then. And it'll be available for purchase for everybody, either through online, through iTunes, or through that old technology called a CD. And with Bruce Moore, it's going to be a program of Americana. It's featuring a singer, one of my favorite baritones, Kevin Days. My God, what a gorgeous voice. And he's going to be coming in and performing some American folk songs arranged by Aaron Copland, as well as songs and arias from Porgy and Bess, because the orchestra is going to be performing Catfish Row, which is a symphonic suite from Porgy and Bess. Some other Gershwin that's also going to be performed there is Cuban Overture as well. And a little bit of Bernstein on there with the music of West Side Story and On the Town. So a lot of Broadway, a lot of Americana. It's going to be a great program.
Orchestra Iowa's music director and conductor, Tim Hankovich. Orchestra Iowa's opening Bruce Orchestra concert will be held on Sunday, September 7th at 7 p.m. on the front lawn of Bruce Moore Mansion in Cedar Rapids. Tickets are available at orchestraiowa.org and will also be available at the Bruce Moore gates, which open at 5:30 p.m. Today's Iowa Art Showcase broadcast is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Program thanks goes to Leo Landis, Jason Weinberger, George Day, Patty Cotter, Sarah Compton, and Tim Hankovich. Production thanks goes to Iowa Public Radio's Tony Daner. Thanks for the show also goes to IPR's music director Al Scherz and KCCK's George Dorman, along with IPR's Jason Burns and Garrett Van Leeuwen. Program research was provided by Nick Carlo. I'm Jacqueline Hallblum. Thanks for joining us. For more information on Iowa Public Radio's programming schedule and Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase, please visit our website at iowapublicradio.org.